Hey everybody, this is Dan Zanes, and you're listening to the CD Baby DIY Podcast.
Welcome to the CD Baby DIY Music Podcast. My name is Kevin, and this is episode 4. Now, for this episode, we have our very first artist interview. Recently, while on his North American tour, we had the opportunity to talk to Dan Zanes. Now, if you're not familiar with Dan's music, he does music geared towards kids and families. And if you've ever browsed through CDBaby.com's all-time bestseller list, you'll have noticed that Dan has reigned supreme there for a long time. In my opinion, Dan is a good example of success as a DIY or do-it-yourself musician. From starting out selling CDs out of the trunk of his car to forming his own record company because he wanted to maintain control of his music, all the way to his approach to signing deals with large corporations like Disney and Starbucks. And even when larger offers were out there, he's kept his career completely independent. I think you'll find his insights and story very inspiring, so let's jump to that interview.
Everybody's talking about it day up at the lake. So let's get our bags and guitars and all the food that we can take. I'll meet you on the corner when the sun decides to break. So
catch the train.
Oh, come on out and catch it.
So, first of all, thanks for joining us today. And
thank you.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you went from being in a band like the Del Fuegos to writing and playing music geared towards kids and families?
It seems like a natural progression, really. But and when I started making music for kids and families, it always would strike me how much like the early days of the Del Fuegos it felt, really, which is just a sort of a overall free spirit that you could wake up any day and whatever is on your mind musically that day, you can make it happen by the end because you're with people that are really just kind of doing it because it feels like something fun to do. And it also was very communal. The early days of the Del Fuegos was very communal, that we just wanted to hang around with other musicians, and there was a lot of excitement in the air that we all felt like we were doing something kind of exciting. I mean, we were really just playing rock and roll. It was no big thing, but it was exciting to us because we were in our early 20s and it felt like the sky was the limit and we could do anything we wanted, I did that for 10 years. It was really exactly the 80s was the time I did it. And what happened that was that as we became more successful, we really got cut off from our audience, and that connection and that social aspect of it all was lost, and we became very isolated, and the wall really went up. And Not that everybody needs to always hang out with their fans all the time, but there's something about being connected to the people that are coming to your shows that I think is really important. And that was before the days of email and a lot of other things that do actually really connect people. We would get fan mail and we would never answer it. And we just, we didn't care. We didn't think it was important at a certain point. And so that was sort of a big lesson to learn. And then by the end of the 80s, my heart really wasn't in it, and it just felt like music had changed, and so I stepped way back, and then a few years later I made a solo record, and my daughter was born, and when she was born I started thinking about the music that she and I would listen to together. I hadn't been around any kids before. I didn't have friends that were having babies or anything like that, so I didn't know anything about music for families. But I heard in my head what I thought it would be. It was almost like the way I thought rock and roll would be. It was, I had this sound in my head, and when I started with the Del Fuegos, we thought we were the updated version of Buddy Holly or Sam and Dave, you know. But and when I was started out doing this music, I just wanted something that my daughter and I would listen to and have an emotional connection to, that we would really just, that we would both really enjoy and would be meaningful for both of us. And just really the updated version of the Folkways records that I grew up with, the Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie and Lead Belly and Ella Jenkins. That was what I thought I would find when I went into the record stores, and it wasn't there. It was very corporate feeling, and everything seemed like it was tied into a TV show or a movie or something. And so I just started making the music that I wanted to listen to with my daughter, and that was really it. And yeah, I really did find a lot of good things along the way. So it wasn't as if there was nothing there and then I thought I would make things. There were really, as I looked deeper beyond the sort of Tower Records, I found a lot of really interesting things for families. But I just had the sound in my head and I wanted to try and make it.
How do you approach the writing process as opposed to like what you might have done in the past with gearing your music more towards kids? I mean, do you feel a larger responsibility for what you write, or are you just trying to make something that's enjoyable for everyone to just gather around and play together?
Yeah, it's important that everybody can relate to it. And also I should say that I only write about a third of the songs on the records, that a lot of it is traditional material that we just take it and update it. And that's really fun. That part of it's been a riot. But as far as the writing goes, I just... You know, what was happening in my neighborhood with people that I knew was that they would go to the big box stores and get the sort of mainstream records, and they would not connect with them, and their kids would probably. And then they, you know, we all want the same thing. We all want the shared experience. And so they would get out their Beatles records, and then, you know, everybody's happy and the Beatles always sound good. But I think there's something about it that's, you miss an opportunity when your kids are real little, because a lot of pop music is really about romantic love and sexual love, and that's just not going to mean anything to a 3-year-old. And the other side of that is that songs directed at children specifically, with themes of, you know, that are very particular to their experiences, putting on a pair of trousers or learning to tie your shoes or eat with a fork, that's not going to mean something to us because we've been doing it for so long. So somewhere in between songs about my old girlfriends and drinking and learning to say please and thank you, I think in between those, there's a huge area. And it was actually a big relief for me, mm-hmm, when I tried to get into the themes of songs that just, you know, that would be, make sense to anybody. Friendship, the natural world, weather, thrift shops, you know. Yeah. Once I got into it, it just all, everything opened up. It's just the opposite of what you would expect.
Yeah. So once you started writing the music and making some recordings geared towards kids, how did you start to spread the word? I mean, I read that it kind of started to happen organically, but what specifically were things that you were doing at that time?
Well, the first thing I did was I made a cassette tape, and it was just to give out to people in the neighborhood. And I never actually thought that I would do this that I would end up doing this for a living. It was really just a homemade gift to give out to people for the holidays, and it was just what I thought all ages music would be. And it was right when my solo record came out, and people were much more excited by this cassette tape than they were by my solo record. And I had more fun doing it. So what I decided to do was, and also I was getting such good feedback, and I was having so much fun, and I felt so emotionally involved in it all, in the world of families, that I just decided that this was really where I was meant to be. So I thought, all right, I'll start a record company, and this is what we'll do. We'll put out these records. So
Festival 5 is your company, correct?
Yeah. And my mother was nice enough to loan me a little bit of money to make this first run of CDs. And we had an idea for packaging that was a little bit more expensive, and people tried to talk me out of it for that reason. But I always believed that if you try and make something, if you have some sort of an idea of what your audience will really respond to, even if it costs more, it's worth it, because that's going to get you the attention, I think. And I felt like everybody was skimping on their packaging for family CDs. And, you know, there's a color front and back, and then you open it up and it goes to black and white, and it's just lyrics, and there's not a lot of information, and it doesn't give you a world. You don't open it up and look into somebody's world for a lot of these CDs. And I thought, you know, we could do this and really make it something special. And also, I felt like just environmentally, I wanted it to, I didn't want to use plastic jewel boxes. I just thought these kids are surrounded by a mountain of plastic crap from the day they come back from the hospital, and I didn't want to be contributing to that. So we figured out how to make little board book packages that were this out of recycled paper and soy-based ink that were the size of jewel boxes, and they were full color, and it ended up not costing as much as I initially thought. But that was one step that we took, and then I had to get 10,000 of them, which is a lot, really. But
did you have distribution at that time? I mean, what were the first steps after setting up the record company? What relationships were you building to actually get it out to on the shelf?
It was really the old-fashioned way. You know, 10,000 of these things showed up in my house, and so they filled the living room, and then I would put them in the trunk of the car. And
that's motivation to sell them, so you can have a place to sit down. Yeah.
Or it's like that joke, it's a million seller. I've got a million of them in my cellar. Yeah. But it was the old-fashioned way. It was out of the trunk of my car, and I bought an electric razor. So for the first time in my life, I shaved every day, which was, so I would shave every day. I'd put on a clean shirt, and then I would go to the stores that seemed like, not record stores, but stores that sold children's clothing and toys and that type of thing. And I would just go to them, and I would say who I was and what it was. And 4 out of 5 places would say, nah, that's, you know, we've got some things, or I'm not interested in music, or I can't do it because the margin isn't big enough, you know, one reason or another. And then the 5th place would say, yeah, this looks really great. And wow, Sheryl Crow's on it. And I love the packaging. We'll try this. And that's how I did it. And we played, and I started playing as much as possible, and we would play for free.
Where do you play at that time? Where were you playing? It seems like, you know, you're not going to play at the normal 21 and older club.
My goal was to get it into as many people's hands as possible. So once that started happening, and really I gave away more than I sold for a very long time that first year. And because I really believed that if people got it and listened to it, that it would grab hold of them. I just had so much confidence in it. And it was also sort of based on my early reactions that people had to the cassette I had made, which became that first CD. And so I just did everything I could to get it in people's hands and not think about money at that point. And then people would say, oh, you've got, will you come and play at our school or school fundraiser, or we're having a party or something like that. So we started doing that, a lot of school fun, you know, weekend fundraiser type things, and we would play for free if we could sell the CDs. You know, that was the thing at that point, was just to, and I really believe in the live experience as the way to sell CDs. It's just a real old idea, and I've always held on to that as the absolute best way to spread the word and let people know who you are and what you're about. And also what I thought that would come from that is that that people would write about it, and we were really counting on press, and we hired a publicist, because I'd never sold a lot of records, but I'd always gotten a certain amount of press, and I thought that this might be the same thing. And that turned out to be the case. And we live in a town of writers in New York, and but it started out locally. And my feeling, and I still think of it this way, was that if we could work out in concentric circles from my house, you know, that sooner or later all the families in my neighborhood would know about this first CD, and then it would spread through Brooklyn and then into Manhattan, and you know that it would just concentric circles out, and that's the way it's still been going. We were just in London, and we went to Australia, and this is almost unheard of for family music to leave North America. Yeah. So the concentric circles are still, it's still my idea.
What's the reception like in London and Australia? Are they?
It's great.
How do they hear about you over there?
Well, I think a lot of people, you know, it's a lot of word of mouth. It's a lot of people who have friends or family that move to other countries, and that starts it. And parents are a really incredible audience, because I think when any of us get turned on to something good, we want to share it with our friends that have kids too. Yeah. So the word of mouth has been really fantastic. And for a long time, when people overseas heard about us from through one channel or another, CD Baby was the way that they could get a hold of it. Wherever they were in the world, they could go to CD Baby and get a copy. So for a long time, that was a huge thing, because if people weren't sending an actual copy, but just saying, oh, we went to a concert or something, you got to check this out, then go to CD Baby. And so you all solved a lot of problems for us. Made it very easy. And also, when we first started, it seems crazy now, but a lot of people were still uncomfortable buying things online with their credit cards. And so having the 800 number was really good. And so we would always put that on our, you know, our postcards or the website or whatever, just to make sure, make it as easy as possible for people.
So when you were first just mainly focusing on the Brooklyn area, were you still doing all the booking yourself as it was spreading out? Was there some point where you said, I've got to hire somebody to do the booking. I can't handle it anymore.
I did. Yeah. Barbara Broussel, who was in the band and sang on the record, she helped me a lot in the beginning. And we were just, we felt like there was no roadmap, which is also the way we felt in the early 80s. And being in a rock band, was just everybody was winging it. You know, no one really knew how to get to from A to B. And this is the same thing. We were just trying to figure it all out. I prefer that. I think that's a much better. And it's sort of nice to see the music business crumble. The old models are sort of caving in on themselves. And I think that opens a lot of doors for a lot of people, and makes for a very, very interesting and exciting time. And that's, I think that's when we all start to get pretty creative with it too. And, you know, when I first started there, I would run into people in the music business, and they would, you know, a lot of them would say, well, you should really just go with a label, you know, go to Rhino Kids, or go to Sony Wonder, or go to one of these places that's already doing it, because you'll never get distribution, you'll never get this, you never get that. And you know, we got all those things, and it all worked out. And I don't hear anybody say that anymore. Nobody says, oh, you can't do it, you know, you can't do it this way, you just got to go with the majors now. And it's really it's just fantastic, because I don't care, you know. In the back of my mind, there's always that voice saying, you know, he might be right. He might know something I don't know. But I for whatever reason, we just, you know, we talk to everybody along the way. We talk to all those companies, and it just, for, you know, somebody would say something that would turn into some sort of a red light, and would say, ah, oh, you know, let's just take a chance. Because in the end, you're taking a chance either way. You know, yeah. You go to the majors. I think that's as.
And in the end, you care about your music more than they do. So.
I think so. It's. I mean, there's some really great people working at major labels, but there doesn't seem to be as much long-term stability. And so even if you have a champion somewhere, there's no guarantees that person will be there next year.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my stomach always starts to hurt, and I just think, oh, come on, let's just stay independent for another year and see what happens.
So was there was it an uphill battle to get the larger distribution? Did they want you to prove certain thing by sales numbers, or what kind of opened those doors for you?
You know what happened? The first thing that happened was we were playing shows around New York. We were with CD Baby, and somebody came to one of our shows and wanted to write about it for the New York Times Magazine. And he found a way to mention CD Baby in the article, and he mentioned that we were one of the top sellers on CD Baby. So anybody reading the article knew as soon as they hit that sentence where they could go to get the CD. And that was at that point where I would get the sales every day. You know, I'd get an email for each sale or however it worked. I can't remember, but that weekend was the wildest experience.
Your inbox was full.
Yeah, it was insane. And that really put us on the map. You know, that one article changed everything for us. And everyone saw us differently, and a lot of doors opened up from that, mm-hmm. from that thing. So, and it came out of left field. You know, it wasn't anything that our publicist had orchestrated. It just came from one person connecting to the music, wanting to tell the story, and there was enough in place so that when the story came out, people could get the music. Mm-hmm. And so that opened up the rest of the country for us, because the Times Magazine is such a big thing, mm-hmm. as far as press goes. And then we started, how we ended up with the distribution that we're with now, is that over the last several years, there have been a number of distributors that function as sub-distributors, where they'll round up a lot of little labels, mm-hmm. and we're with a group called Virtual Label, and they pull in a lot of little labels and they run it through the Ryko Warner's system now. Okay. And they're good people over there. They're real music freaks, mm-hmm. And so that's worked well for us. So, and you know, and all along we've stayed with CD Baby, and that's been another great way for it all to work, because people are coming to CD Baby that have never heard of us before and mm-hmm. finding out about us through that. So it's sort of putting together the best possible pieces, I guess, is the way. But this was a kind of a crucial ingredient to mm-hmm. get that. To get that distribution. Mm-hmm. So this is a fairly good time for that, I think. There's a number of these distributors that will channel the little indies into the bigger places. Mm-hmm. And
how did the door open for you for Disney, getting on Disney Playhouse?
It initially opened when that Times Magazine article came out. And they called to see if I wanted to come up for a meeting, and I went and I met, and I said, you know, it's really nice to meet you, but I'm not at all up for television.
So they read that article on their own and just contacted you out of the blue. You didn't really send out any.
No, because I wasn't interested at that point. I've always felt that television and children is a pretty bad combination, mm-hmm. for the most part. But I mean, in another way, it's like alcohol. It's not necessarily evil in and of itself. It's just the way that it's abused in a lot of families. But what I came to realize, so I said no, thank you, and I really liked the person that I met with, and I've certainly appreciated the interest. But what I started to realize over the next several years was that we could be touring every night or every day, and we would never reach a lot of families whose only access to culture is through the TV. Mm-hmm. And it started to feel like I was clear in the message. You know, as we started doing this, it became the interesting thing was that I finally, you know, I had a message in all this, which I never had before. And the message is really that you can do this too. You know, mm-hmm. that the CDs, the live shows, everything we do, we hope it's just a stepping stone for people to want to do their own thing. Mm-hmm. And it's simple. You just need a couple songs in your head and you sing them with somebody else. And it's a joyous experience that we tend to leave to the professionals. Mm-hmm. And So that's why we put lyrics and chords on the website, and that's why we're so focused on ukuleles, and we started putting lyrics and chords in the CD packaging, and just to make it easy for people. And I thought, you know, this, the ultimate way to carry this message to the most number of people, it will be through television if we can make the right show. So then we went back and we said, all right, we're ready.
So did you produce the shows and then hand them over to Disney, or did they, were they involved in the production of those?
Well, we did a series of videos for Noggin, another mm-hmm. channel, and then we did a couple for Sesame Street, and then we signed on with Disney to develop a show, starting with a series of videos that they would run, and they would get, you know, they sort of, everything is tested and test marketed, and so they started running the videos, and they tested very well. People really dug them, and we did them exactly the way we wanted them. And it wasn't the usual Disney thing, but they were they've been really supportive of us doing it the way we see it, you know. And it's sort of clear what our thing is. So it would be silly for anybody to want us and pay us to do this stuff and not want us for what we do, you know. Nobody would win. But so now where we're at is they've been running the videos, and we're about to shoot a pilot for a TV show, and then we'll, you know, sort of go step by step. If the pilot feels good to everybody, then we'll shoot a season, and then we'll shoot more, you know. So but so far so good. It's a weird thing to be really in a big corporate scene like that, it comes down to the people, and the people mm-hmm. there have been really good and supportive. And, you know, business affairs at Disney is another notorious story, but I'm focusing on the positive, which is the people we work with.
Well, since this podcast is for artists, are there any things that artists should be aware of getting into situations like that? I know you don't want to speak negatively necessarily, but just things that, you know, they need to look for when someone like a big corporation like Disney says, hey, we like what you do. Are there some things, hey, make sure you check this out before you sign on the dotted line, because they're really going to want to be involved and tweak this or that? Or what kind of things should people look for?
Well, I think, you know, thinking back with the Del Fuegos, we signed what we knew was a bad contract, and we had a lawyer do it with us, and we had to make the decision, how badly do we want to put a record out and with a big company? And it's I think is always a spin of the wheel, but we knew that we wouldn't make any money from it, but we also were totally optimistic, thinking we're going to get our records out and really good things could happen. And in the end, I think it was worth it. You know, I think it was worth it to take the bad deal just to get out of Boston at that point. But now I see what I do a little bit differently, and I feel so good about it, and I feel so confident, and I think it's become a little bit more important to make sure that everything, you know, everything is tempting in one way or another, and it always feels like it's going to take you where you want to go. But there's, I think if one offer comes along, there's probably another one behind it. And if for some reason it doesn't feel good, I think we always have to be ready to walk away. You know, I think that we always have to feel like we could walk away from anything. And then we're always in a position of power, you know, if we believe in our thing enough that we don't have to feel desperate. And that's just sort of an internal thing, you know, what's the motivation? And I think art and commerce can really coexist peacefully. But
are you guys being proactive now, searching for those deals, or are they still just coming to you? Like, I walked into Starbucks a couple months ago and saw catch that train. So what are you guys doing on that front? Are those still just coming to you, or are you pursuing those opportunities you think are a good mix of art and commerce?
We're trying to keep our eyes out for right now. What's always helped us on the touring front is to be you know, we're, because we're a small label, I think typically, you know, if we were in a record company, they might be inclined to give us some money for tour support, mm-hmm. Which I know we had some of that when we were touring with the Del Fuegos, because it's expensive touring. Yes. And there's, you know, there's seven of us on stage. It's a lot of people. And so when we first started with the family music, Stonyfield Farms Organic Yogurt gave us some money to help with the tour support. And then in exchange, we would thank them from the stage, and then people would give out organic yogurt in the lobby after the show. It was kind of a perfect situation, I would say. No banners on the stage, no nothing. It was very clean in the venue, but out there, there's organic yogurt. So, I mean, that was ideal. Mm-hmm. And then Annie's Organic Macaroni was introducing a sort of an organic goldfish, and they supported our touring for a while and gave that out at shows. And So we're looking, you know, there are a lot of good companies to be involved in, and Starbucks has been fantastic. Working with them has been great, and got the music to a lot of people. So I think, we're always on the lookout for people that we would like to be involved in, and if we have a common goal, it can really work well. And again, it just falls under that getting creative with it and looking for the people that. We're looking for situations where we all want the same thing. And, the stage could get cluttered with banners pretty fast if you let it. But I think that a lot of companies recognize that that doesn't do them any good either, because it feels like a hard sell to a crowd that doesn't want a hard sell. Mm-hmm. You know, people can feel pretty funny about it. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's, there's a lot of different ways to do this, but we're always on the lookout, because we need support.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you want people to leave with after they've seen Dan Zanes and Friends live?
I think the best thing that people could leave with is just a sense of fun, and we can do this too. And let's sing some songs. You know, it's a little hard at first if you're not coming from a family that sings together or culture of music making. But I think that's the idea, is just if people feel inspired to make their own music, that's really the name of the game. Because I think, you know, we live in pretty divisive, fearful times. And I think music making is such a joyous experience on the most casual level. It's a joyous experience, and it gives us, I think, it gives anyone a sense of what life could be, the best possibilities out there, and it builds the bridges, and it connects us to one another, and connects people from various backgrounds, and it's just, there's so much power from it all. So if we can in any way get that across to people, then I would say we've done something useful.
Well, thank you for your time. Your manager, a road manager, has given me the look, so I think it's time. But thank you for taking a moment to speak with us.
I love CD Baby, and I've been inspired all along the way with the ideas that come back to those of us that sell our records on CD Baby, and it's been a wonderful community to be a part of, and it's really been inspiring for those of us in the indie world. And it doesn't make it feel like we're just off on our own. It makes us feel like we're part of a big group of people that are trying to do it in a new way.
Everybody gather around, fine friends are here. They're gonna fill the air with the wildest sounds. Fine friends are here.
All right, well, we're back with yet another roundtable discussion. My name is Kevin, and I have
Chris
and Robert.
They're here with me. And for today's discussion, we're just going to be reflecting on some of the ideas brought up by Dan in his interview. So what do you guys think?
I thought the interview was great, and actually it was really awesome to actually be there and watch the show and, you know, see the kids just going crazy in front of the stage for them. The music was great. It wasn't, you know, like I wouldn't have thought going to a kid's concert that I would have been so entertained. I mean, it was a really great concert, and the interview was just the icing on the cake.
Yeah, that was the one thing I wish we could have included in the podcast somehow, and I don't even think he really has any live DVDs available yet, but the concert was pretty good, and we'll get into some of the details later, but he just had the overall package dialed in. He had an amazing band, one of the best drummers I've seen in a long time. I went in with just, you know, kind of average expectations, but he really blew me away, and I was like, wow, that was, he's got a good thing going here.
I unfortunately missed the show, but
haha.
Yeah. But I really liked how, just judging from the interview, how it seemed like as an artist he was open to going to that place where his talents met sort of the needs of an audience, and he wasn't necessarily going to stick it out as a singer-songwriter, or an adult singer-songwriter.
You know, the fates sort of stepped in and were like, you're really good at doing this, and he listened, you know, totally, like, which was cool, rather than just being like, no, I got to be a rock and roll star in this way like everyone else. He was like, no, like, people are really paying attention to these kids' songs I wrote. And he totally went with it.
And it did come from, seem like, a natural place. He wanted to write songs that his daughter enjoyed.
Totally.
So it wasn't like, how can I make money? Oh, I could be a kids' artist. He just kind of fell into it and then said, yeah, I'm going to follow this. This is great.
That's one of the things that really came through in the live performance. You could tell he really had a well-developed story about why he's doing that music and what the purpose is behind it. He's really into, you know, just encouraging people to get together and play music as a family, you know, with their kids, and just kind of developing that culture that in America, most people just sit around watching TV. They don't gather as a family and play music together. And one of the cool things he did in the show was that he had some local family members. I don't know how they selected it, if it was through a radio station or just through his website, but he had a couple people from a family who play together come up on stage and they played a couple songs with them, and it was
totally,
it was pretty cool. I'm sure it was a thrill of a lifetime for those kids, and I'm sure it'll be very inspiring and keep them wanting to pursue music. But so he even incorporates it into the show, and he's really big into you know, making sure the chords and lyrics are in all the albums so people can play the songs themselves. And, you know, like he says, not just leave it up to the professionals to do.
Yeah, I think that his, I mean, his attitude towards his audience was just really inspiring. He's, you know, he looks at them as part of the package, something he really has to pay attention to and cater to. And he really encourages them to participate, just trying to basically inspire people to have fun making music in the same way that he's having fun making music.
At his own expense, sometimes it seemed like he was willing to put that extra dollar or thousands or however many.
Yeah.
Much it cost into the packaging, into the product to make sure it was inviting and people felt like they were taking part in it.
Yeah, and I think that's one thing, you know, he talked about how starting out, it was, you know, he kind of did the old school way of, he just threw the CDs in his trunk and started going to stores and selling them, you know, one store at a time. And I think that's one thing that the packaging really helped. I mean, he developed a product that was enticing all the way around. It wasn't just, here's my CD, you want it? No, yeah. Okay, move on. And it's just this junky looking thing that he just made on his computer. I mean, he really took the time and effort to really present the whole package, and you know, he got some rejection, but every once in a while someone said yes, and he just kept going. And I thought it was funny how he mentioned how it was the first time he shaved every day.
I love the fact that he knew up front he was gonna have to give a ton of music away. It seems like at CD Baby, so many people we talk to every day are just petrified of getting ripped off here and stolen from there. And, you know, part of promotion is giving away CDs. If you press 1,000, you should expect to give, you know, 200 to 500 away up front. Yeah. And he just kind of was like, I'm going to go with it.
The thing that was interesting about him is, you know, he gave away a lot of music at first, but a lot of those people were turning on their friends to, hey, you got to check out this guy, Dan Zanes, if you want some good music that you can listen to with your kids. And even spread to other continents, which was, I thought, very surprising, you know, because he didn't really have anybody promoting it in England and Australia, but yet people who had friends overseas were sending it to them as gifts, and, you know.
Well, what he really discovered is almost what any and every businessman is looking for, not to necessarily call an artist a businessman, but it's sometimes they have to be one and the same. But he found a market. that really, you know, like an empty marketplace. It was like needed or wanted what he had to offer, and he filled it really well. There were children's artists out there that were doing something, you know, that was popular and, you know, maybe a little bit Disney-fied and tame. And like, he sort of, you know, he talks about sort of filling the space between pop songs and the really childish child songs and sort of being the middle ground, you know, right, bringing in cultural awareness and education and, but still making it cool and fun at the same time.
It was nice to hear how he really didn't condescend to his audience, but who was probably mostly children, but treated them like valid individuals who can have an artistic shared experience, mm-hmm, along with their parents as well.
And also another thing about his whole experience that I thought was really cool is that he just started locally in his own neighborhood. And then he mentions concentric circles in a different way than Lisa mentioned concentric circles in episode. Oh, she mentioned affinity circles. That's right. but he just targeted, he lives in Brooklyn. He targeted Brooklyn, and then they just kept moving out from there. He wasn't sending packages to places in LA and Nashville, just random places. He was going to places where he could show up in person. And I think one thing that was, I also noted about him going to these stores, he didn't just go to music stores. He went to a lot of like children's specialty shops, which may seem obvious to someone who's trying to sell kids music, but I think many times musicians don't think outside of the box as far as who the end customer is. They just think that, yeah, my music should be in a music store. Well, there's lots of stores out there, probably more so than there are music stores, that are like specialty shops that cater to something of similar interest that people might also be interested in your kind of music.
Well, and how perfect. I mean, like, how little competition is there as far as going to a kid's store and trying to get your CD, you know, recognized, when going to a record store that has thousands and thousands of CDs, right, and you just, you know, and the people there are just sick and tired of people coming in with their CDs, mm-hmm, and Dan Zanes just goes straight to the source. Like, I know who my audience is. I know where they shop. And it's not necessarily record stores. It's, you know, these kids' shops. And what a great way to start out.
As far as how things started to, doors open up for him, you know, he mentioned that the best way to get out there and promote yourself is to play live. And that's how most of his big breaks happened. I mean, the whole thing with that he mentions the New York Times article, that seemed to be like a real point, a turning point in his career.
Right.
It wasn't anything his publicist solicited. It was just this guy had heard something and came to the show and wrote this huge article, told him people to get it, CD Baby, and just this landslide happened. And
it was a magic moment, but it wasn't, I think, the sort of magic moment that artists are sort of always hoping for, in the way that he had to work all the way to that point. In order, he had to prepare himself for that.
Yeah,
moment.
And, like, and I think when you're in that position at that point, when that happened to him, I'm sure it was exciting, but at the same time, I'm sure he kind of felt this thing of, yeah, that makes sense. I've been busting my butt every day, shaving every day, putting on a clean shirt, going to all these places, spreading the word, playing shows as much as possible. Yeah, eventually that stuff's going to happen. I mean,
yeah.
So I'm sure there was some satisfaction in that, but also, you know, kind of, yeah, it's about time. But it was cool to see how, even as those things happened, he still has kept everything independent. You know, Disney's comes knocking on his door, he's getting a TV show, Starbucks has his latest CD, and just all those opportunities happened on his own terms as well.
I loved his, I forget, was it yogurt? His
the
sponsorship story, where, like, you know, it wasn't a sleazy deal, it was something that was fun. Or even if we're talking about artists outside of the children's realm, they're creative ways to get some financing, whether it's, you know, a relative that has a little extra money to spend, or a company that has something to offer, and you don't have to sell it from the stage, but it can become part of the experience, the live show experience.
Yeah. I mean, what an excellent business opportunity. I wonder if he didn't refuse a number of not excellent business opportunities,
right,
before he settled on that one.
I'm sure he probably did.
That was another great thing he said, though, actually, about not being afraid to say no, because you should have the confidence that other opportunities are going to come along.
Right.
Just wait for the right one.
Yeah, that's probably the number one fear most musicians have in the back of their mind, that if I don't say yes to this, it's going to be my only opportunity. And especially, you know, Dan said when he was in the band, the Del Fuegos, how they signed a bad contract. They knew it was a bad contract, but they kind of thought, this is the only opportunity we might have. And ended up not doing so well for him. So this time he's, you know, just taking it one step at a time, you know, thinking it through everything and making sure it makes sense before he does it. You know, I could tell that he probably spent a lot of time really thinking through the Disney deal before he went ahead with that. And I'm sure he still probably thinks, did I do the right thing? And right. Yeah, I did the right thing, you know, because, you know, he mentioned that sometimes dealing with a huge, massive corporation like that can be difficult. And, you know, he didn't comment, say anything negative,
right.
But, you know, you can tell that it hasn't been just an easy street the whole way.
But it sounds like his focus on community and relationships has also informed a lot of his business decisions. He talked a lot about how much he liked the people that he was working with at Disney. And I'm sure that his the sort of focus on relationship that he has, and not necessarily just on getting his name on the dotted line, has probably also helped him, that he has people that are rooting for him, fans and friends that are working for him.
Oh, that's huge. I mean, if he's got those real relationships with like people at Disney, they're gonna fight for him too when they're being told by their bosses, we need to do this, and they're like, no, Dan's not gonna like that. They're gonna fight for him because they know that, hey, he's a great guy. You know, he's really got a good thing going. He knows what he's doing, and let's just trust him, you know. And they won't always do that with people, everybody, yeah. You know. So one of the last things I wanted to say is that, you know, Dan in there kind of at the end wrapped up what his whole thing behind what he's doing live and with the music and kind of the message he has was that, you know, you could do this too. This isn't just something for the professionals. And I think that's what really inspires people when they come to his show and hear his music, that he's not just saying, hey, look at me, look what I can do,
right.
Listen to my songs. He's saying, hey, you can do this too. Take this experience home with you. And I think that's what really takes the Dan Zanes experience beyond the CD and beyond the live show. He really gives the people the ability to enjoy that at home and take it beyond just what he can do.
Definitely. Like when he was talking about putting a whole world in the CD production, in the booklet, he was saying, you know, that, well, I could have a front cover and a back cover, or I could kind of try to create my own little universe in the album. And that's great. Like, he's really, he doesn't look at it as just music or as just performance or as just, kids music or whatever. He looks at it as a relationship and a community and everything else that it is.
And it's definitely not all about him. It seems like his art is a carrying on of a tradition. You mentioned Pete Seeger and those Folkway recordings. And it's not all original music, too. He's sort of sharing the traditionals or whatever kind of cover music he liked and
definitely
working it out and then passing it on. And hopefully the people that go home will play them on their ukuleles.
Indeed.
He's got a great story, and that makes people want to be a part of what he's doing. And even people that may not be into kids music, like, you know, Robert and I saw the concert, and yeah, you know, I don't have kid CDs at home that I listen to, but
Soon,
my daughter is six months old today. Today?
Congrats.
He just had me the whole time for the show. It's just like, wow. You know, there are people out there who are still, you know, really passionate about what they're doing and just making their story just flow out through their show, through their CDs, and the experience beyond that. So, well, before we close out this roundtable discussion, I just wanted to mention that you can email us at info@cdbabypodcast.com. And we've received some great feedback from you listeners out there and some awesome show ideas. And we'll be getting some of those in the works. So if you've got any show ideas or anything else, you know, feel free to email us. And if you have any success stories or anything like that that you want to share, we'd be glad to read them on the show. Also, Robert, you are starting a...
We've got the new DIY music news, so you'll see that in the sidebar on the website. You can put your name and email address in there, and we'll keep you up to date with shows and other exciting tidbits. So,
and we promise not to spam you.
We promise not to spam you.
So yeah, sign up for the newsletter, and as always, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast.
Bye-bye, my Rosie. I'm going away, but not to stay. And I won't be home tomorrow. Bye-bye, bye-bye.
Well, that's going to do it for another edition of the DIY Music Podcast. As you probably guessed, the featured music in this episode was by Dan Zanes, and it's off of his Catch That Train album. Also, I'd like to mention on the podcast website, we now have photos from our interviews, so you might want to check that out. The website is cdbabypodcast.com. You'll also find some show notes that go along with the shows, as well as past episodes. And as always, feel free to email us, info@cdbabypodcast.com.
Bye-bye, and I won't be home tomorrow. Steamboat's coming around the bend. Bye-bye, my Rosianna. She's loaded down with harvest men, and I won't be home tomorrow.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Music Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.